So move to talk two for Arcadia for Charity. This is three High Renaissance Venetian altarpieces by Bellini, Giorgione and Titian, respectively. So we're set here in Venice. There's a very special place, of course, hailed as another world by Francesco Petrarch, the humanist scholar of the 14th century. Also known as the Queen of the Adriatic, the City of Light, and of course La Serenissima, the most serene republic. And in northeastern Italy, we have 118 small islands in the lagoon in the Adriatic, founded in 421 AD, which is St. Mark's Day. So synonymous with trade in the East, in particular with merchants, and therefore spices, herbs, things like silks and fabrics are the commodities. This was only enhanced by Marco Polo travelling there in the late 13th century to the East. Glassware is synonymous with Murano since the 13th century also. So this all led to great colour, richness, opulence, wealth, decadence, etc. The colours and the light so significant in Venice, of course, in the lagoon and the buildings themselves being polychromatic, coloured with different marbles and hues, all of that reflecting in the beautiful blue of the lagoon. Its roots are rather Byzantine more than classical, so it's a heritage of decoration involving gold, mosaic work, think of St. Mark's in particular. This was furthered by the booty or plunder, the spoils from the Crusades they're very active in particular the sack of Constantinople in 1204. So again, bringing more splendour, riches, including the four horses from the quadriga that's now on the front of St. Mark's and stolen by Napoleon, of course. The development of materials then, we move really from the prevalence of tempera and fresco in certainly Florence and previously places like Padua, Siena, Pisa, to oil, which is inherited from the north, in fact, via somebody called Antonella da Messina, an artist who was from Sicily but came to Venice in 1475 just for a year, bringing with him the Ars Nova, in other words, the new art from the Netherlands, from Flemish art, Van Eyck et al. And this was seminal, groundbreaking. Also, we think about the culmination, really, of all of these ideas in Venice, meeting with the altarpiece. Now, formerly, this was the polyptych with many hinged panels, which are very kind of separate, in a sense, with narratives from the Bible. Yet, Venice brings this together in the form of the Sacra Conversazione, which is a kind of unification of all of the stories, the messages and the ideas in one key central panel. And because Venice had very few trees, there was no wood particularly for these big polyptychs on altarpieces. So it turned to be canvas more than anything, which was ubiquitous given the sails for the travel by water. Also, Venice was damp, humid, so therefore the survival rate of frescoes would not prevail. So, in other words, this is the new medium, oil on canvas. We associate with people like Titian. The other factor really that changes is the integral space, the idea of the architecture of churches, and that harmony is absolutely key in terms of the paintings that include the architectural church space in the canvases themselves. And this then, as I say, realised in the Sacra Conversazione, the meditative atmosphere, the reflection and the divine introspection, almost otherworldly private piety, because also the plague in 1348 onwards had halved the population in Venice. So it had a hugely resounding impact on their mindset, if you like. And we see that reflected in the rather maudlin tenor of many of these altarpieces in Venice. The first of the three, the Bellini San Zaccaria altarpiece of 1505 in the Church of San Zaccaria. So it was built for that, painted for that building, of course. And it's a late work for him, relatively late, a tripartite harmonious composition and thus a quasi-triptych in a sense. Great symmetry, balance, harmony throughout, not just in terms of the colour relations, but also, of course, the geometry. There are arcs that echo with, say, the wheel of St. Catherine the Martyr, but also the palm frond and the drapery of St. Peter and so on. Also in terms of the figures and their attitudes, their countenances, the front figures placed in the foreground look outwards towards the viewer, and yet the middle figures in the sort of second recessional plane look inwards And so there's this kind of mirroring of differences. Figures are nearly life-size, and they are set within this participatory space, the setting potentially more Byzantine than San Zachariah itself, so maybe the fictive niche with its beautiful recessional gold mosaic dome is based on St. Mark's. The distance we feel, perhaps, though, is within the fact that the saints and the holy figures in their Sacra Conversazione are slightly unattainable, slightly distant from us, the viewer, from the outside, as it were, although we are, of course, introduced to their narrative too. Christ is naked and thus vulnerable. He raises his foot, and this is suggestive of the triumph in the future resurrection, so proleptic symbolism or prescience. We have above the Madonna and Child an Al-Antica King David sort of bust in relief as a reminder of Christ's regal ancestry or lineage. St. Peter is rendered in shadow. This is synonymous with the plague aforementioned. He also has his keys and the book where you enter the names of the nobles that enter into heaven. Also the Libro d'Oro from Italian noblemen in more contemporaneous terms. St. Catherine, as I say, as the martyr with the wheel, only half of it showing really, and the palm as her attributes. On the other side, our right, is St. Lucy. And this is based on the word, of course, luce, linked to light. She has the crystal as the presence of God or the light. She's also shining in light as that light strikes her deliberately. And she is the patron saint of blindness. She had her eyes gouged out for the faith. And then to her right is St. Jerome or Zechariah, who translated the Bible into Latin. He was seen very much as a father of the church. Therefore, he's in the cardinal red. He was also the father of St. John the Baptist. And then some hermeneutics. Above in the dome, we have the suspended ostrich egg, rather beautiful, suggestive of the virgin birth. The ostrich lays its eggs in the earth and somewhat to protect it and rather forgets about it and thus leaves them to hatch alone in the sun. So that idea of breaking forth from the tomb in the resurrection also paralleled. The lucerne is the oil lamp that's suspended also, which is based on the Latin lucerna or Italian and is associated with Greeks and healing. We also have the landscape opened up either side, left and right, as sort of coulisse, the wings of the theatre almost. And this is the Italian lantano, meaning distant. On the left-hand side, the fig tree, obvious symbolism for sin. Judas hung himself from a fig tree, temptation and so forth. And then on the right, paradoxically, the antithesis, the eucalyptus on the right-hand side, symbolic of wealth, abundance, purification and healing. The colour, so important, of course, the fabrics, the drapery, just brilliantly polychromatic, typical of Bellini, but the relationships or interrelationships of the colour. The primary figures are in primaries, red, blue, gold or yellow. The secondary figures, in terms of their hierarchy of importance, are in secondaries. We also have the marriage and juxtaposition of the complementaries, red and green, blue and orange, yellow and violet. So all very choreographed by the artist. This was taken by Napoleon and yet returned eventually. So we move to Giorgione next, who was in fact the pupil of Bellini and in some ways tried to sort of usurp him as well as show an influence. So he's from Castelfranco, that was his birthplace, and this is in the Veneto region, just as Venice is the capital of the Veneto. And this is the Castelfranco altarpiece in the Duomo, or Cathedral, of Castelfranco. This was a piece commissioned by a condottieri called Tuzio Costanzo, and a condottieri was a kind of mercenary soldier hired in, often from England, in fact, as a mercenary figure. And the piece was to commemorate his son, Matteo, who had died either of a fever or in battle in Ravenna in his early 20s in 1504, so really the year before. So honorific, commemorative. And the family crest or coat of arms, often known as the stemma, is on the base of the throne, which is obviously a high throne, featuring a catafalque, which is a decorative wooden framework supporting the coffin of the departed for commemorative reasons. And the allegory here is that St. Liberalis is also possibly alluded to in the form of the son Matteo, because he died in 434 on an island in the Lagoon of Venice. And here he is possibly a knight, or is it St. George? with the flag of Treviso, and Liberalis is the patron saint of the old church of Castelfranco. Now, Giorgione's technique here is of alla prima. So instead of perhaps doing the drawing, the disegno of the Florentines first, he would paint directly onto the surface. So there is a lack of preparatory modelling and drawing. Now, there is this aspect of him responding to and outdoing the teacher Bellini. St. Francis is clearly based on the San Giobbe altarpiece of Bellini. They're both Franciscan churches, and yet he mirrors the pose in this version. So that's the homaging, if you like, but he also usurps him by opening up the landscape from maybe the cast of the previous work, the San Zachariah altarpiece either side of the landscape. He opens it up further. And this is perhaps redolent of the growing interest in the landscape, in air, atmosphere, the elements, the visit of Dürer from Germany, who, of course, was advocating, like Leonardo, this interest in the natural environment. Also, the humanist readings at the time, particularly by people like Giorgione, the interest in Virgil and these beautiful Arcadian sort of golden utopian visions of the past, pastoral idylls of Virgil's eclogues or Georgics, also Ovid and Metamorphoses. So that realism in the space is really important above the Madonna and Child. We don't have a fictive kind of trompe-l'oeil golden apse, but instead a real landscape. Also, that kind of realism perhaps is born of the informality now of the poses of the sacred figures. They're kind of almost languorous, like the atmosphere. There are two viewpoints, therefore, two vanishing points, both one for the figures in the interior and the other for the landscape in the exterior. The tiles provide the orthogonals and transversals leading to a vanishing point, which is symbolically on the womb or the pudenda of the Virgin for the Immaculate Conception. The elevated position of the Madonna and Child suggests hierarchy of their divinity, but they're not oversized as per Byzantine tradition. Similarly, in terms of this interest in humanist cults and sects, well, Pietro Bembo had recently produced his lyric poetry, usually performed on a lyre, and a poetry which expresses intense personal emotion, the literary equivalent, therefore, of Giorgione's poesia, as they became known, a form of visual poetry. And then the third in this trinity of altarpieces is by Titian, the great painter, you know, said to be the painter of princes and the prince of painters. This is the Pesaro altarpiece, a little later, almost a decade or so later, in 1519, but finished in 26, in Santa Maria Gloriosa dei Frari in Venice, so often just known as the Frari, where, of course, he'd already painted earlier the Assumption in the high altar in the same church. Now, this has been moved, the Pesaro altarpiece. It was originally on the wall, the side of the nave on the way to the high altar. And the reading of it is very much from this angle where people would approach it when assessing down that nave. And the subject then is of the Bishop Jacopo Pesaro, the leader of the papal navy, and it celebrates or commemorates a victory over the Turks in 1502. So we think about Shakespeare perhaps here with Othello, and yet also earlier The Merchant of Venice, of course. There's an equivalent. The donor, therefore, is featured, as is his family on the right in particular. Pesaro himself is on the steps, kneeling on the left. Now, we also see a Turk in a turban, and this is a victory over the Turks, as we've already mentioned, but also suggestive of a victory of Christianity as a faith over Islam. The coat of arms of Pope Alexander VI and of the Pesaro family are featured on the flag, which also has the laurel and the olive of victory there. The soldier in the armour is possibly St. Maurice or possibly St. George again. We also have the prisoner of war alongside, abutting the soldier of triumph. St. Peter, of course, in central position here, who has the book again, the Libro d'Oro, or the book to register those permitted into heaven. Madonna and Child at the vertex in terms of the composition, but of course off centre, very unusual this, and perhaps this diagonal sweep left right and askew kind of almost oblique angle is typical more of the developing style of mannerism rather than the high Renaissance tradition that he was born into, really, Titian. Lovely that his wife was the model for the Virgin, although very sadly she passed only a year or so after this through childbirth. The Holy Family, interestingly, are portrayed with greater dynamism, movement, fluidity perhaps, and also in primary colours, the red, the blue, the gold again. And they're more corporeal, in other words, rounded, 3D, fullness of form. Now, contrastingly, the other figures of the Pissarro family are in muted hues and colours. They're flatter, 2D, and they're more static. So there is that deliberate contrast there in portrayal. We also have St. Francis of Assisi on the steps, and alongside him, slightly hidden, is St. Anthony of Padua. The donors, as well as aforementioned, of the Pissarro family, and the nephews and other close family members too. The Christ child is depicted as a bambino vivace, in other words, a lively infant. He's playing, hiding under the veil of his mother, the Virgin, and almost sort of joshing with a close figure, which is, of course, St. Anthony and St. Francis. But it shows a humane touch. And the foot now is beyond raised, perhaps, taking a step, possibly out of the tomb, as triumphant in resurrection. We also see, typically, in terms of the geometry here, the high Renaissance pyramids, the geometric composition, and this is really suggestive of triangles and thus the Trinity, as well as the square, the circle. So this we dubbed theology through geometry. Great interactivity to keep the viewer busy. The eye is darting about the place because all of the figures interact in one way or another with each other, and you can follow the force lines around the piece to keep that eye engaged. But interestingly, this asymmetry, the askew qualities of where we view this from, the fluidity of these Holy Family in particular, this leads more towards mannerism that is to prevail later. We also have the two putti that hold a cross aloft up, and they're sort of borne by, or shored up by, the clouds at the top of the picture. And we have monumental pillars, which were painted later, possibly not even by Titian, some theorists claim.